Welcome to Season 2 of Level With Us, where we'll be taking even deeper dives into the root causes and the intersecting issues of Central Ohio's housing crisis. Whether you're a first-time listener or a follower of the pod, thank you for lending your ears to an effort that is desperate for more attention, more voices, and more action. Everyone is affected by our housing shortage, whether you're a homeowner, a renter, a landlord, or someone experiencing homelessness or housing instability. And all of us have a role to play in fixing it. So here in Season 2, I'm bringing on more experts, community organizers, and leaders that I hope inspire more of you to find out what that role is. We're back this month with David Staley of Columbus Futurists. If you haven't heard the first episode with him, I encourage you to go back and listen. It really lays the groundwork for what we're discussing today and gives more context as to what futurism is and how it can be a useful lens through which we view even current issues. I think the main point of today's conversation is that while futurism does rely on certain factors or drivers that indicate the likelihood of one outcome or another, it's not a crystal ball. We are not resigned to the predicted outcomes as if they're prophecies. We have agency that allows us to shift our current methods to achieve different outcomes. We have the power to reverse engineer the future. Knowing the risks and opportunities is what allows us to build a future we want, rather than passively waiting for it to get here. So to kick off this episode, we actually discuss climate resiliency and energy efficiency, how we may reimagine the ways we build and the energy sources we can rely on.
Well, let's start with solar. There are so many indications that it is such an excellent way to generate electricity. Full stop. There's just so many ways in which solar works, and in all sorts of ways, the United States has been falling behind, say, the Chinese. Especially in the development of solar arrays, solar panels. The way things are right now, and I know this because I priced this recently, if you as a homeowner want to put solar panels on your roof, in some ways that is an expense. That is a pretty significant expense. And so my concern is that it's only those who can afford it will be able to take advantage of this. Mm-hmm. There's going to be all sorts of inequity like that. So bring the price down. I mean, don't make it free. I mean, yeah, make it free if you can, but let's think about ways to bring the price down. I also think, and I've written about this with Columbus Underground, that municipalities, that the city, think about solar arrays. Right now, there are big solar farms, for instance, literally on farmland. And we can debate about how efficient that is, what that does to farmland. There are all sorts of other places that we could be placing solar panels. Mm-hmm. On roofs of downtown buildings, over parking lots. I'm not going to get the number right. I think it's like 27% of the surface of downtown Columbus is parking lots.
Imagine, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, imagine if those had, and you've seen these, I'm sure, lots of parking areas. Imagine if those had solar arrays over them. I'm not going to remember the name of the sculpture that's downtown near Gay Street. Gay.
I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
There are ways that we could think, and that's the fabric sculpture that's placed above the street there. We could be thinking about something like that
current.
As a kind of solar array.
It's called current.
Yes, that's right. Imagine if current were solar panels or some sort of version of that, and they extend all the way down High Street. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of imaginative ways we could be thinking about these sorts of things. We could be thinking about not just simply materials. That's sort of an obvious one. We're thinking about climate change. How concrete, for instance, gets made. We could also think about architecture. I'm not going to have any names, but there's some very interesting African architects right now that are building structures, building buildings that don't use, for instance, traditional HVAC. They're designed in such a way to harness natural air flows, change the way you think about windows. You still allow natural light in, but you change the way you think about windows. So rethinking architecture, just rethinking building, I think. Mm-hmm. And then broadly, I'll say one other thing about climate change is I think Columbus, but I think broadly the Midwest, is going to be an attractive location, especially for people living on the coasts, to get away from the effects of climate change.
Yeah.
And so it's not just that, you know, we don't have to worry about rising sea levels here, but one thing the Midwest has, at least as of today, as of this recording, is water. And it was part of the reason why Intel said they were, not the biggest reason, but it was one of the reasons Intel said they were moving here, was access to water, which they don't necessarily have in, say, Arizona or places like that. And so I think the availability of water is going to be a real attractor for people to the region, but to Columbus in particular.
Yeah, and that's just going to drive up demand.
It absolutely is, yes. MORPC, of course, are saying we're going to be over 2 million by 2050. That's just in the city. Mm-hmm. We're already at 2 million in the MSA. Mm-hmm. There's every reason to think that demand is going to continue.
Yeah. Sustainability is expensive.
Sustainability is expensive. Not acting is also very expensive, I think.
Truth. Yes. In the long run, yes.
Yes.
We discuss more about climate resiliency and the attractiveness of the Midwest as an escape from climate crises in Season 1, Bonusode 3, with Michael Corey of the Human Service Chamber of Franklin County. But moving forward, this conversation with David is the first I've ever heard of the Pact of Free Cities. We'll get more into what that means in a moment, but essentially we discuss how municipalities could leverage their own power to get more out of the federal government, particularly funding for housing, but also for more autonomy on other issues, such as minimum wage and, notably, immigration management.
I think we might reach a stage where cities are going to say, you know what, we want more of this sort of autonomy. We want to maybe even push for some kind of independence. I think part of what's happening in Los Angeles right now is one expression of that clash.
Yeah.
That Los Angeles has one idea about immigration, for instance. Bring them in, more of them. This is what makes a city great. You have a federal government that obviously has taken as one of their tasks mass removal, right? And immigrants, send them someplace else. And we're seeing that on the streets of L.A. We're seeing that kinetically clashing. I don't know. This could be a moment where you'll start to see more of a push for home rule, more autonomy for cities. There's a group of mayors in Europe have created what's called the Pact of Free Cities, and it was started in Eastern and Central Europe, frankly, as a way to push back against some of the nationalist governments in places like Hungary. There's now, and they say unabashedly, you know, we're for progressive values, and we're pushing back against national governments that are illiberal. There are now close to 40 cities that are part of this pact, most in Europe, but there's a few around the world. There is one city in the United States that is a member, and it's Los Angeles. And I suspect we could see more. But that's all context to talk about, for instance, housing. That cities are going to want to either act on their own, or frankly are going to look to the federal government and say, look, if you want to have this sort of control over us, then why don't you do something and help us with housing? Because it's not just a Columbus problem. The housing shortages, the kind we've been talking about here, you can point to practically, certainly every major city in the United States is feeling this, and has to do with demand, and has to do with limited supply.
Mm-hmm.
So look to the feds and say, help us, right. rather than sending in the Marines. You know, if we're talking about a supply issue, if we're talking about we're just simply not building enough houses, if we're going to see immigrants either push to the margins or indeed forced to leave the country, this is clearly going to have an impact on the construction industry. And the argument's always made, well, you know, they're taking, you know, jobs that Americans, you know, could be doing. And there's very little evidence that's what's happening, that what is keeping Americans from going into construction is that someone has taken their job. There's just not enough evidence for that.
No, there's actually a lot of room for people to get into construction.
Plenty, yes, plenty. And in fact, I know locally at least, we have to import from the United States, we have to import construction workers into the city. This is how, if we finally build the Intel plant, it's probably going to have to be built from laborers, from construction workers from other states. Mm-hmm.
A major threat to American jobs may not be immigration, but it could certainly be AI, in a roundabout way. A few weeks ago, Microsoft released a list of the 40 jobs at highest risk of AI replacement. These include jobs in advertising, customer service, data science, public safety, telecommunications, technical writing, web development, and more. So if AI forces people out of their jobs, where do they go? What new employment do they find? Or, in lieu of a replacement job, how do we make sure people who are replaced by AI in the workforce are still housed, still taken care of?
I was talking about labor force participation a moment ago, and I think that something that most people just aren't talking about around AI is, well, obviously it's automation. This is how we're talking about AI right now, the concerns about automation. Am I going to have a job? Are you and I going to have jobs if our tasks can be automated?
And you write.
Well, and we know that large language models can write for us. Mm-hmm. But what we're not talking about at the same time, I think we're rushing headlong into, well, let's just automate jobs. Let's just sort of do it. One of the things I tell audiences and in my writing is an algorithm, an AI, won't take your job. A human being using an AI is going to take your job. That's a concern, that's an issue that a lot of people are facing. What we're not talking about right now as a society is, as more people are displaced from employment, what are they going to do? What are they going to do to support themselves? What are they going to do to have housing, for instance? And, you know, the answers tend to be, I think, a little too facile. They tend to be, well, you know, there's been technological unemployment in the past. People will just find other things to do. And I think with this wave of AI automation, it's not exactly clear what that is. Yeah. What are those other jobs going to be? I don't know if anyone has been able to articulate that. And the other example is UBI, Universal Basic Income. And as I'm sure you're aware, there are all sorts of experiments around the world about this. But all of which is to say, we are going to have to, frankly, redesign our economy and our society around automation.
Yeah.
Because if machines, even smart machines, are going to do most of the work and provide most of the value, then what do human beings do? How are they going to support themselves? How are they going to house themselves? There are very few people that are talking about this, hardly any politicians, but it's exactly the sort of political debate and discussion we need to be having right now. I think it's going to become a bigger issue, and we are, and I'm using my words deliberately, we're going to have to redesign our society.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, all of our value now is dictated by how much we work.
Yes, yes. You are in many ways defined by your job, and again, I draw a distinction between work and employment. I think that we all engage in a lot of work that we're not paid to do.
Mm-hmm.
Employment means it's work that you do for a wage, right, for some sort of compensation. I think it's employment that is imperiled in an AI future, but not work. I think that people still want to work. My wife likes to garden. She likes to cook. Mm-hmm. This is hard work. These sorts of things. Neither of which she's paid for, but she enjoys doing it.
Right.
I think that designing a society where people are permitted to work, even if they're not employed, is the direction we're heading. But that is real long term thinking, and that is a real heavy lift. That will be hugely expensive.
Yeah. That's asking people to value unpaid labor.
And that's what I mean by a social change, a cultural change, a mm-hmm. mindset change.
Yeah.
People who aren't employed are lazy in mm-hmm. our society. We label them as lazy. That attitude is going to have to be completely altered.
This attitude around labor, work, and employment can and has influenced the ways we treat those who are unable to maintain gainful employment, folks who are disabled, experience chronic pain, and of course our senior population. The infrastructure to care for these subsets has all kinds of gaps. Assisted and independent living facilities are costly, meaning a fair share rely on family members to provide for their long-term care, almost all of this care being done without pay. And as millions of boomers enter their retirement and age into their 70s and 80s, the need for supportive housing is only growing. While the time for planning for such a need was maybe a couple decades ago, David talks about how we could build now for a future that not only cares for our vulnerable populations, but prioritizes them and prioritizes longer, healthier lives in general.
I'm going to beat a dead horse. There are very few politicians that are talking or thinking in these terms. One notable exception is Governor DeWine. Mm. Who, at least before the pandemic, was exactly thinking about these issues. And then the pandemic came, and he had other things to sort of worry about. But I mean, it's a demonstration that it is possible for political leaders to be thinking these terms. As I think we've been hinting at all throughout this conversation, the challenge is more than just buildings. It's more than just building houses. It's a larger systemic issue. So to prevent the kind of scenario you were just describing, as that older Ohioans will find it harder and harder to be housed, we need to think of this as a larger system that includes the physical, the legal, the financial, the social systems that support this. I wrote a couple of years ago in my next column. And I completely invented this name, gerontonomics, that we would, in a sense, have to rethink the very nature of the economy, that we would center the economy around aging populations, both their needs, servicing those needs and their particular challenges, but also creating the conditions for there to be an aging population. So it's not just simply about serving people in their 60s and 70s and 80s. It's about serving young people as well. To say creating an economy, creating the conditions so that you could be a healthy 60, 70, and 80 year old. That's what I mean by gerontonomics. Mm-hmm. Because right now that's not the way we think of it. We think of the systems that are there to support elderly Americans, Social Security, for instance, Medicare. They're called, they're called entitlements, as if it's not something you really, are entitled to, or it's something that you think you should have, but it's really a luxury. Mm-hmm. A gerontonomic economy would be one where these are not entitlements. This is the purpose of the economy.
Yeah.
Is to serve, to create the conditions so that people live long. I can point to a stat right now. You could look at life expectancy. In Ohio and the United States ranks, I think, about 40th in the world in life expectancy. We're in the same category as places like El Salvador. In Ohio among states is lower than the national average, and there are parts you can look at, especially like like Appalachian Ohio, South and Southeast Ohio, where the life expectancy rates are considerably lower, like in the 60s. In the United States, I think life expectancy is around 78, I think is what it is. Go to Japan and it's 82. For women in Japan, it's 88. That's average life expectancy. What if we looked at life expectancy as one of our chief metrics, our chief economic metrics, and increasing, improving life expectancy, not just simply living longer, but living well, living healthy. What if we centered that as a key part of the economy?
You mean instead of the GDP?
Instead of GDP, precisely, yes. instead of other sorts of measures, what if these quality of life measures were placed at the center, especially the idea that having an older population is a good thing rather than a burden in the way we think about it. That's how we talk about it right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially since, you know, some of the more common characteristics among the aging population is physical disability or,
right.
We're all like one unlucky incident away.
Yes.
From being disabled, and so
yes.
Planning for that would also be beneficial.
And being bankrupt because you wouldn't be able to afford the medical care
right.
necessary,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of part and parcel of that. That's a choice that we've made
mm-hmm.
as a society. That's not the way things are. We have made that choice deliberately, and we could choose differently.
So how do we choose differently? David proposes we do so by reverse engineering the future.
So there's and it's becoming an important part of my practice. I didn't really think along these lines. It's only been the last 5 years or so, but it's called idealized design. It's an approach to the future where you're not trying to speculate what's going to happen. You're actually trying to make the future that you want. And so you start by articulating. So what's the future that we want? We want affordable housing for everybody, right? We want inexpensive solar panels. You sort of state that, and then you work backwards from that. I call it reverse engineering the future. Okay, that's the future we want. What has to happen for us to get there?
Yeah.
And that's not just simply the choices that we make individually, but it's like changes in the larger system, the larger political economic system. But when you do this exercise, you develop a kind of a roadmap. And I use this with my students. And my students are pretty pessimistic about the future, pretty hopeless. They've used that sort of language with me. And doing these sorts of exercises, they say, now I feel like I have some agency. Now I feel like I could be doing things right now because that's the future that I want.
Yeah.
So you have to be realistic. It's not going to be easy. If that was the future that we all wanted and it was easy, we'd already be living in it. We'd already have it. But that approach to the future is a way to, I think, drive agency, drive political change.
Level With Us is brought to you by Homeport and is recorded, mixed, and edited by Lauren Sega. All sources are in the show notes. Homeport creates strong communities by developing quality, affordable homes on a cornerstone of dignity, security, and opportunity. To learn more, or if you'd like to support our mission, visit us at homeportohio.org.